Welcome to Fisherwomen. I'm Katie Osborne. Today we are visiting Western Tennessee to talk about fly fishing. My guest is veteran fly fisher and writer Jen Ripple. Jen has been sharing fish stories and encouraging others along their fly fishing journeys for years. She founded Dunn, the first fly fishing magazine written and edited by women. There is some background noise in the interview. I hope you will bear with it because Jen has some great stories to share. Jen, thank you so much for coming on the show. For all of the listeners, would you please introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Jen Ripple, and I am the editor-in-chief of Dunn Magazine, which is an international fly fishing lifestyle magazine that is tailored to the female audience.
Thank you. To start things off, what brought you into fly fishing? Did you just see it once and that was it? Or did you come to it more gradually?
No, I actually brought myself into it in a backdoor kind of way. I was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, working at the University of Michigan, and it was really cold one winter, and I saw a fly tying class online. Not an expensive class, and I thought, well, I'll try that. I'm not crafty in any way, but for some reason that just seemed like something fun and out of the norm. And so I walked into the fly shop, and from that point forward, it was just like, this was my thing. From the people to the shop dogs to learning to tie these flies that I had no idea what to do with because I had never even picked up a fly rod from that point forward. And I was really lucky because in Michigan is where Trout Unlimited started, and so there's a big group of fly anglers there. And so there was already a group of women that I could learn to cast and be part of, which was important because even though I'm a very strong woman and I'm not easily intimidated, something about casting a fly rod at the fly shop just was scary to me. So knowing that I was going to be in a group of eight other women who had never done it before or who were very new to it, taught by women, was really important.
Yeah, I can imagine. And since you've come to fly fishing, have you ever gone back to conventional fishing?
I think the last time that I fished with anything that wasn't a fly rod was when I was a child, and it was like a cane pole and a worm and a bobber, right? I was in my mid-30s when I actually picked up a fly rod. So for me, I just fell in love with everything that is fly. It's just such a beautiful sport. I mean, I don't know one person who hasn't seen someone cast a fly rod and said, oh, I would never want to try that. I think it's just one of those things that's just so beautiful that looks really difficult, but it's not. Everything about fly fishing is just sucked me into the black hole that is this sport. You know, from the beauty of standing in a river to floating down a river to being in a lake, you know, casting a fly rod at anything that's under the water that you can catch, you know. And people always say, well, you lived in Chicago, there's no trout in Chicago, and now you live in Tennessee on the west side where there's no trout in Tennessee on that side. You can't fish for bass with a fly rod. Well, yes, you can. You can fish for anything that swims and is legal to fish with a fly rod. And that's the beauty of it. There's always something to learn, from the entomology to a different type of cast to a different species you can target. And then, you know, one of the best things about fly fishing is the community. So water seeks its own level, they say. And people who fly fish are just such a great group of people that I can't imagine not having them in my life now. I don't know how I lived before I had my fly fishing friends.
A quick aside on entomology. Entomology is defined as the study of insects. For fly fishers, though, it also refers to understanding the insects the fish are eating in order to select an appropriate fly to fish. This requires understanding the categories of insects and their life stages, so that you can start to identify the bugs on the water in terms of group and age. You may also hear the phrase, matching the hatch. This comes later and refers to the ability to select a fly that a fish is more likely to pursue because it mimics the insects currently hatching at the water's surface. Successfully matching the hatch requires experience, study, and lots of time on the water. It's part of learning to think like a fish and observing the rhythm with which different species of insects emerge from aquatic larvae to winged adult. This mindset helps you select the fly that most effectively suggests the idea of the tasty inverts hatching at the surface. Now, back to the interview, where Jen is sharing what brought her to Tennessee.
From Michigan, I moved back to Chicago because that's where I had raised my kids. And then two of my four kids and my grandkids specifically moved to the Nashville area of Tennessee. And so I really was very tired of all things Chicago. And I wanted to be closer to my kids and my grandkids. And I literally opened up a map and saw all this water that is the land between the lakes and was like, wow, there's got to be great fishing there. Seriously, I saw the picture and then I was like, oh, I wonder if there's a town at the base of all that water. And I looked and there was. And so I immediately, like I'm talking, this is like a 2-minute endeavor here. I went to Craigslist and I looked up houses for rent in Dover, Tennessee, and I found the house that I now own. Called the guy who was renting it that day and said, hey, I'd like to come down and see it. He said, okay. I called my mom, said, hey, Ma, let's go down and check out this house. So we literally drove from Chicago down to Dover, Tennessee, spent about 20 minutes here. As I was driving out the driveway, I called my now very good friend Dana back and said, hey, Dana, I'd like to rent that place. And drove back to Wisconsin and went to Belize on an Orvis catalog photo shoot. And when I came back, the house was already packed up. We literally left the next day, drove down here, unpacked everything. I went into town to buy a bottle of wine and realized I'd moved to a dry county.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. You said the part of Tennessee where you are isn't what most people think of when they think of fly fishing country. So how is the fishing? What do you like to fish for? And where do you most like to fish?
You know, I've been surprised by the fishing. So it is all big bass water. It's where Kentucky Lake is one of the areas that borders the land between the lakes. And so we have a lot of professional anglers that win lots and lots of money fishing for bass on these lakes. In the past 4 years that I've been here, we've seen the fishery change because there's such a huge Asian carp population coming to this area that they're trying to get rid of right now. I also love to fish this area. There's two big lakes, Lake Barkley and Kentucky Lake, and they're very different, but they're still very, very challenging, so I love that. They get very warm during the summer, and the fish go deep, which as a fly angler, it's its own different challenge, but, you know, and there's so much water that you never really know where they're going to be. You have to really study the water, so I'm still learning it, and I love that. It's not like I can just, and you never know what you're going to catch. There's all kinds of different species in Lake Barkley and Kentucky Lake. And for instance, there's a place that we found that has a lot of gar in it, big, huge gar, like many different species of gar. And so we dub that the garden. And so I like to fish for gar now in the garden.
We do love a good pun. And you told your story of what brought you to fly fishing. So what motivated you to expand on that by starting a fly fishing magazine?
Well, I was writing for a Midwest fly fishing magazine called A Tight Loop, but I was writing a woman's column. And I'm a really good double entendre writer, and I like to kind of, you know, play around with words that way. But I really wanted to write a serious article for a woman's magazine. So I looked around for one and there wasn't one. So the editor, who happens to be the web guru behind A Tight Loop magazine, who I'd been working closely with, I asked him what he thought about starting a woman's magazine, and he was shocked there wasn't one already. And so we both took a day to make sure there wasn't one, and then we just started it. And that was June of 2013, and by September we had our first magazine. Our motto early on was empowering women, not ignoring men. So we do have a good male population of subscribers as well, because first and foremost, we are a fly fishing magazine. It just so happens that the vast majority of our authors are female.
That's great. Thank you for that. And couldn't help but notice that that was a really quick turnaround from idea to reality. And 2013 is not that long ago. You said the space was pretty empty when you entered it. Has that changed in the time since?
Dramatically. It has dramatically changed. I would say about 6 years ago, we saw things really escalate as far as the female audience. Back then, when we started Done, there was no Athena and Artemis, the woman's fly shop. There was no Sarah Bella Rods. There was no fishy wear, you know. Manufacturers weren't really making any gear for women. They were, but it wasn't super techy. It didn't fit really well. And so, you know, the women that were in the sport, they had to wear their brothers or their dad's waders, you know. And when you're not comfortable in the water, you don't really want to do it very often. And so with Dunn coming out, and then shortly after, things like United Women on the Fly and Fishy Wear and Athena and Artemis and all these really great women started these organizations or these companies that either make women's gear, make fly rods, or connect women, which was really good and very instrumental. And so the snowball effect kind of took place. So as there was more stuff for women, as women saw more women on social media getting involved in the sport, more women wanted to get involved in the sport, there was something for them to get involved with, something for them to connect with other women and have a platform. And it's just grown since then. So exponentially it's changed since 2013 when we started the magazine.
That's awesome. And with that change in demographics, I'm curious, has Dunn changed alongside those changing demographics, or have you really tried to stick with a consistent message throughout?
So that's a great question. When we first started, I wanted to have a magazine that was empowering to get the female audience or women on the water. And so when I look at being empowering, the way that I'm empowered is not by reading the same regurgitated stories that are in every other magazine out there, or by seeing a very skilled professional angler out there doing something. It's by the everyday person, you know. If I see someone that's doing something that's cool and they're just an everyday person, that makes me feel like maybe I can do that. And so from the beginning, we've told the everyday angler story. And our authors, 99% of them have been female authors. That's our big thing, and that hasn't changed at all. What we have seen a change in is we do a very back-to-basics kind of thing where we will re-educate people or educate them the first time on the basics, because I find that even in my own life, a lot of women, and men even too, I think, you get to a certain point where you've been fishing and been in the fly shop for maybe a couple years, but no one's ever really taught you the basics. So then you just kind of go along with the fact that you kind of know the basics, even though you don't, because you don't want to seem stupid. And so we found that our audience likes, and the new audience likes, the basic stuff, which we've implemented a little bit more. And we've been very experiential kind of in our stories, because they're written by everyday anglers, their personal stories. And so it's changed a little bit from that. We still do that in a very heavy scale, but we also do a lot of educating, a lot of reviews. You know, people know that the gear that we are going to tell them to buy and that we love is because we love it, not because we're getting paid to do that. And so we've become a very big platform for people to find the gear that they can rely on, especially now, you know, where you can't go into a store and try stuff on. It's become important for them to have a trusted source. And so we've seen it, you know, as our audience has grown, we've seen confidence in our platform grow, which has been good. And so we educate more than we did at the beginning.
That's fantastic. And speaking of where Dunn is today, I'm hoping you can talk a little bit more about the process of creating the magazine and getting it to where it is now. What was that like? And I'm imagining there must have been some surprises along the way. So if so, what were they?
We did it in stages. I don't have any background in publishing or anything like that, so I'm just an entrepreneur at heart, and so when I get an idea in my head, I'm just going to be like a bulldog and just keep going forward until it's actually realized. There were a lot of things that I didn't know, and I guess it's good that I didn't know them, because maybe if I knew everything, I wouldn't have undertaken it, right? Some of the surprising things. So fortunately for us, we started as an online magazine only, digital only, because we started it in 2013 when people said that print was dead. And so we were able to grow our audience astronomically without very little money out of our pocket, which is good because I'm not a rich person. And so then from that point forward, when we already had the audience, then when everybody had been asking for a couple of years, where can I buy your magazine? Or when are you coming out with a print magazine? Or our advertisers would say things like, we'll advertise when it's in print. We came out with a print magazine. You know, I thought it wouldn't be much different doing a digital magazine to a print magazine, but there's a whole host of different responsibilities when it comes to a print magazine, you know. So that was a real learning experience. And the paper quality and the conservation behind a print magazine, for instance, there was really no vegetable inks. And if there were, they were super expensive back in 2013. So everything kind of fell into place with our coming out with a print magazine. But that being said, there were a lot of things that I didn't know, like the fact that our magazine would, because it was big and beautiful, it would weigh a pound and a half, and it would cost a lot of money to ship a pound and a half. It would cost a lot of money to make the stamp foil on the front. So that kind of stuff was a learning curve for sure. But it didn't deter us because we felt like it was something that was needed. So we just kept going forward with it, and it came out. And then I will say that once that we had made it bigger and oversized and everybody loved it, we were like, oh yeah, now we can't go back and make it a less expensive magazine. We have to keep going forward with what we have, you know. It is a coffee table magazine. You know, one of the things too is we made it big and beautiful because that's what I would have liked to have seen in a magazine. And it's so much work to produce each one. And there's such a concerted effort between all the authors and the photographers and my staff and all that, that to just get that one magazine out the door, that I didn't want to just make a magazine that people would page through and then just toss in the garbage. I wanted something that was going to stay around.
That really sets your publication apart. To give listeners an idea of the content of your magazine, are there any stories that have appeared and done that really stuck with you over time as favorites?
So one of my all-time favorite articles is called Gradual Untangling, and it's about a woman, Mari Kitagawa, who's from Japan, and she was born with a birth defect on the left side of her body, so she can't walk very well, you know, and her left arm doesn't work very well. But she's such a determined woman. She decided that she wanted to catch world record fish on a fly rod. So she is my biggest inspiration. She would get off the train one stop early every day on the way to work and walk that extra distance just so she could strengthen herself and so she could practice walking so she'd be more stable on a boat. She would do the same thing on the way home from work. And then when she got home from work, she would go into her closet in the dark and just practice stripping line into a basket in the dark so that it would be second nature for her to do. And she would tie knots upon knots upon knots in the dark. And while she was just sitting on the couch, everything that she would do, she would just keep tying knots so that she wouldn't have to think about, you know, having to tie a knot so that she could tie the knot quickly so that she could get to the fish. She wouldn't miss a fish because of that. And then she has caught many world record fish on a fly rod now, and she's quite the inspiration in Japan and for us. Yeah, so that's like one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, I can see why. Such an inspiration. So last question about Dunn. What's the story behind the name?
That's the hardest part of starting any magazine or any kind of business is picking the name, because once you do, you're stuck with it, right? So I wanted one word that would be easy to put on logos and on hat, you know, as a logo that would be easy on hats or shirts or, and that was kind of a play on words because I'm like a nerdy word person that way. And Dunn is the stage of a mayfly, which is one of, as you know, one of the biggest hatches that is an important hatch in fly fishing. And so it just seemed like the right fit. And then I could say things like, been there, done that, or get it done, or watch out, boys, it's done, you know.
You obviously love fly fishing. I know why I think it's important, but why do you think it's important?
I think there's no other sport out there that can be done by so many people at any socioeconomic level. It doesn't matter if you're male, female, young, old. It's one of those sports that's just such a beautiful sport and gets you back out into nature, which I think is super important now that we're talking about the COVID thing, you know, getting outdoors. I think so many more people are getting outdoors where they weren't before. They're just so sick of being in their house that they need to go out into nature, and they want to do that where there's a lot of space. And so we've seen exponential growth in fishing since this whole thing happened, because it is one of those things that you can actually do, which is good for us and good for humankind in general, right? To get out there. I think it's important to educate and get people into fishing, because I think when you do that, you create a conservationist, because it's hard to want to speak up and protect the waters if you don't use them and you don't realize that they're there. They're easy to overlook a lot of times. You know, it's amazing. I moved from Chicago, but to hear those kids in the very urban areas not realize that you know, in Chicago specifically, that their water comes from Lake Michigan, which is right there. And how many of them have never even been to Lake Michigan, even though it's a mile away from where they live? And so by getting people involved, and women, I love getting women involved, because then we get our children involved, and then we create a whole new generation of conservationists. And once we take care of the upcoming generation, we don't have to worry about the ones that are coming after that, because they'll automatically want to protect those sacred places.
So true, and so great to have that reminder. My last question for you today is, would you please share your favorite fish story?
Some years ago, maybe 3 years ago now, I had the privilege of going with the group from Temple Fork Outfitters, TFO Rods, and we were going to go spend a week on a liveaboard in Cuba. So I went down with just my friend Rhonda, who was part of TFO, and got to meet all these really great people. And there were, I think there were like six of us, spent a whole week on this big liveaboard. And we did nothing but every morning get up and go on a skiff and fish all day long and then come back to the boat. And they had this great food and everything. Well, my favorite fish story comes out of that. I happen to be very fortunate to be on the boat with Rick Pope, owner and the man who created Temple Fork Outfitters. So it was my time up at the front of the skiff, and I was standing on the skiff, and the guides started yelling, tarpon, tarpon. And so we're out in the middle of this beautiful, pristine water that, you know, surrounds Cuba. And I was looking, and I'm thinking, that those aren't tarpon. I don't know what those are, but they're really, really big. And so I just thought, well, I'm going to start casting to them. So I started casting to them, and it was a giant school of big jacks. I mean, just like huge jacks. And so I hooked this jack. And for a long time, he just started taking off. He didn't even realize that he was hooked at first. He was that big. Rick Pope turns around and he says to the guide, he says, are you going to pick up the anchor? You know, are we going to go chase him down? And he says, no, she can fight it from here. And so Rick says, well, that's going to be reflected in your tip. And so I'm fighting this fish, and I had never fought a fish that was that big before. And fortunately, here's Rick on my boat with me as my partner for the day, who creates fly rods. And so he was able to walk me through, you know, the bend of the fly rod, how to fight a fish that was that big, what the angle of the rod needed to be. And so I landed this giant jack, and immediately, I'm a very big catch and release angler. That's all I do. I don't really eat fish, except for maybe if it's a tuna, I would probably eat that right there on the boat. But so they take this jack, and the guide gets the jack, and we get him in the boat, and he immediately throws a wet towel over the top of him and sticks his foot on top of him. And I was like mortified. I'm like, oh my God, what are they doing with this fish? What are they doing with this fish? Well, they took it back. We immediately went back to the boat and took it into the kitchen, and it was the biggest fish that anyone had ever caught on the liveaboard the whole week. That was the biggest fish that was caught. And we ate that jack for 4 days. We ate it every way you can imagine. It was really like tuna. It was amazing. We ate it raw. We ate it in where they put all the oils and the vinegars in it. I mean, it was crazy. We ate it. And the big joke was, well, Jen, what would we have eaten if you wouldn't have caught that jack?
What a great story. Thank you, Jen, so much for sharing that and your journey and expertise, and for all the work you do encouraging so many to learn and grow as fly fishers. You too can have a beautiful fly fishing magazine in your inbox. Subscribe at dunnmagazine.com or follow the links in the show notes. Thank you to Rick Pope for the wonderful cover photo for this week's episode of Jen with a Jack Crevalle. Jen has an article out in the latest digital issue of Dunn with pointers for folks starting out fly fishing. This is timely because this episode marks the first in a series on fly fishing this season. I may be a fisheries biologist, but I didn't grow up fishing. So this season, I'll be learning. I'll be talking to more fly fishers along the way and sharing my journey with all of you. If you would like to join me in learning to fly fish, I've linked some casting videos in the show notes to start us off. So send me your photos of your backyard practice casts and follow Fisherwomen on social media to get fun photos and helpful resources for learning fly fishing. It's at FisherwomenPod on Instagram and Twitter. If you're already an experienced fly fisher, tell me how you got hooked on fly fishing. You can leave a voicemail at 707-633-3934 or send an email to fisherwomenpod@gmail.com. Select messages may be aired or read on a future episode of the show. And now it's time for something completely different with our weekly creature feature. This week's creature feature comes from Marshall Fan, a graduate of the Humboldt State University program in marine biology.
I'd like to introduce the scalyfoot snail, the scientific name Chrysomelon squamiforum, or as many informally call it, the iron shell snail. These creatures can be found at deep sea hydrothermal vents in the Indian Ocean. As implied by its informal name, this snail incorporates iron sulfide into its shell and scales. Although other animals use different metals in their shells for defense, the scalyfoot snail is unique in using iron sulfide. Most snails have their fleshy foot exposed, but the iron shell snail has scales that cover its foot, and it looks like the scale armor used by ancient Roman legionnaires. Researchers are still not sure what the scales are used for, but some have speculated that they are used as an extra layer of protection. The shell of the scalyfoot snail looks like the shell of a common garden snail, but only has three whorls and is compressed. It is hypothesized a bacteria on the outside of the snail helped form the iron sulfide shell, but the bacteria is yet to be discovered. The existence of this bacteria is speculated because this snail itself cannot feed and it relies on an obligate endosymbiotic bacteria for nutrients. That is to say, a bacteria that lives within the snail cannot live anywhere else and is necessary for the snail's survival. The snail has a reduced radula. Think of it as a tongue full of teeth that is found in all snails. And it is reduced because it relies entirely, again, by its obligate bacteria for food. The deep sea environment of the scalyfoot snail is harsh, with crushing oceanic pressure, extreme temperatures, and toxic organic chemicals. It lives in a zone nearby the hydrothermal vents that is relatively cool and full of hydrogen sulfides that a snail uses to survive. It was discovered in 2003, but a scalyfoot snail has been already replaced by the endangered species list. Their habitat has been threatened by the advent of deep sea mining. Nodules of rare earth metals, critical for our electronics, can be found at deep sea floor where these amazing creatures exist. It is hoped that placing these snails on endangered list will guard it more attention and prevent destruction of their habitat. These snails could hold a key to new discoveries in genetics, materials, science, and much more. And just like any other species on the planet, they are innately special.
Thank you, Marshall, so much for that creature feature. If you would like to learn more about the fascinating scalyfoot snail, please follow the links in the show notes. And that's the show. Thank you once again to my wonderful guests, Jen Ripple and Marshall Fan. And thank you to my wonderful listeners for joining me today on Fisherwomen. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave a review. It really helps. If you would like to submit a creature feature for a future episode, please visit the website at fisherwomenpod.wordpress.com or follow the links in the show notes for more information. The Fisherwomen theme was mixed by me using sound sourced from SFX Go, Orange Free Sound, and Free Sound. Thanks again for listening, and be sure to tune in next week when I'll be speaking with Ralph Lampman, Lamprey Project Biologist for the Yakama Nation. Ralph shares his love and knowledge of lamprey and talks about the exciting work being done to restore this historic and culturally important fishery. Until next Monday, happy fishing!